Well, friends, our study is on the seven last plagues. I normally leave the studies to others, but I was persuaded to take it because I was the one that had selected it, and they thought that I would know all about it. But that's not actually true. I don't know all about it, I'm afraid. It's a symbolic passage, and so it's something that a lot of the verses we can't be completely certain on. There could be more than one view. Some of them are fairly clear and others are not. It's rather a big passage, and I don't know whether we'll get through it all or not, but we'll do the best we can. You've got the guidelines there, haven't you? I should just get a copy of those as well as my own notes.
You do have the answer.
Me one. Well, you just said I do have the answers. I've got the word answers here, but that's. Well, we can't be sure whether they're the right answers or not. Well, the first one, what is the significance of the number seven? I think maybe for the sake of time, we might have to take more than one in with it. It has been suggested that these plagues link in with the 10 plagues of Egypt. Is that it's the case? Why are there only seven? And what is the difference in the significance of the number 10 to that of the number seven? So I think we'll take 1, 2, and 3 in together for the sake of time. Once a question has been answered, we can leave it at that then, unless you've got a different view. And we'll be happy to get all the different views you have, but if you're just going to express the same view, you don't need to do that. Or if you have the same view but you feel it hasn't been explained properly, or you can make it clearer, well, speak up. Righto. Now, 1, 2, and 3 are open for your thoughts. We got the roving mic, and it'll be coming around.
You're not going to read through that passage, are you, brother, or not? You'll just go straight into the questions without looking at the passage?
Well, maybe we should just look at the passage. Would somebody like to read the passage for us? Perhaps you might like to read it as you mentioned it.
Yeah, from where to where? You don't want to read the whole of chapter 15, do you?
No.
But you do want me to read verse 1 of chapter 15, and then I'll read chapter 16, is that it?
That's right, yes, that will be good.
From chapter 15, verse 1, I saw in heaven another great and marvellous sign, seven angels with the seven last plagues. Last, because with them God's wrath is completed. Going now on to chapter 16. Then I heard a loud voice from the temple saying to the seven angels, go, pour out the seven bowls of God's wrath on the earth. The first angel went and poured out his bowl on the land, and ugly and painful sores broke out on the people who had the mark of the beast and worship his image. The second angel poured out his bowl on the sea, and it turned into blood like that of a dead man, and every living thing in the sea died. The third angel poured out his bowl on the rivers and springs of water, and they became blood. Then I heard the angel in charge of the waters say, you are just in these judgments, you who are and who were the Holy One, because you have so judged. For they have shed the blood of your saints and prophets, and you have given them blood to drink, as they deserve. And I heard the altar respond, yes, Lord God Almighty, true and just are your judgments. The fourth angel poured out his bowl on the sun, and the sun was given power to scorch people with fire. They were seared by the intense heat, and they cursed the name of God who had control over these plagues, but they refused to repent and glorify him. The fifth angel poured out his bowl on the throne of the beast, and his kingdom was plunged into darkness. Men gnawed their tongues in agony and cursed the God of heaven because of their pains and their sores, but they refused to repent of what they had done. The sixth angel poured out his bowl on the great river Euphrates, and its water was dried up to prepare the way for the kings from the east. Then I saw three evil spirits that looked like frogs. They came out of the mouth of the dragon, out of the mouth of the beast, and out of the mouth of the false prophet. They are spirits of demons, performing miraculous signs, and they go out to the kings of the whole world to gather them for the battle on the great day of God Almighty. Behold, I come like a thief. Blessed is he who stays awake and keeps his clothes with him, so that he may not go naked and be shamefully exposed. Then they gathered the kings together to the place that in Hebrew is called Armageddon. The seventh angel poured out his bowl into the air, and out of the temple came a loud voice from the throne saying, "It is done." Then there came flashes of lightning, rumblings, peals of thunder, and a severe earthquake. No earthquake like it has ever occurred since man has been on earth, so tremendous was the quake. The great city split into three parts, and the cities of the nations collapsed. God remembered Babylon the Great and gave her the cup filled with the wine of the fury of his wrath. Every island fled away, and the mountains could not be found. From the sky, huge hailstones of about 100 pounds each fell upon men, and they cursed God on account of the plague of hail, because the plague was so terrible.
Good, thanks for that, Brother Darrell. Well, it's open now for your thoughts. We're taking in the verse 3, what is the significance of 7, what is the significance of 10, and it has been suggested that it links in with the plagues on Egypt. In that case, why are there only 7 of the plagues here? It was 10 on Egypt. Thanks.
If I might just comment further, while the mic is still over,
yes,
in this department.
Sure. Yes, go ahead.
If you look at the plagues of Egypt in Exodus, yes, you find the blood of the Nile's water turns to blood. Then you've got frogs, gnats, flies, livestock, boils, hail, locusts, darkness, and the firstborn of the death of the firstborn. If you look at our plagues here in Revelation, you've got painful sores. Yes, certainly you've got the sea turned to blood, that's similar to the Nile. Rivers and springs became blood, that's similar to the Nile. People scorched by the sun, that's something completely different. Darkness, that's similar to the plagues of Egypt. The Euphrates dries up, that's not in the plagues of Egypt. Lightning, thunder, severe earthquake, and Babylon split into three parts, not in the plagues of Egypt. So, to me, I think it should be considered as a separate symbolic picture and not the same as the plagues of Egypt. I can't see any similarity at all in that. Thank you, brother.
Good. Thanks for your thoughts, Brother Darrell. We had one here. I think it was Brother Graham, wasn't it? Yes, Brother Graham down the back here.
Going back to question one, the significance of the number 7. I've got two verses which I think say the same thing about symbolising the number 7. Exodus chapter 29 and verse 37, which read, the King James Version, 7 days thou shalt make an atonement for the altar and sanctify it, So there's a work of atonement being done there for 7 days. And then in Ezekiel chapter 43 and verse 26, 7 days shall they purge the altar and purify it. So if we just took those two verses alone, then it seems to me that number seven has got to do with a purification process.
Good, thank you, Brother Graham. Any other thoughts on that one?
Mine is to do with the second question. I wondered if the other three were the three woes of the three last trumpets. They were three woe trumpets. And it seems to me that these plagues are particularly to do with the wrath of God. It's mentioned in quite a number of places. I think we had a couple of it read, 16:1 and 15:1 and verse 19 of chapter 16. And it, I was wondering if it had a connection with back in chapter 14, whether this is more of a detail of it, of the vine of the earth and it's cast into the winepress of the wrath of God there. And I think it's all for to try and bring repentance and conversion. We'll probably see as we go along later on. Thank you.
Good, thanks very much, Brother Henry. Yes, that is what has been suggested, that the three woes and the seven plagues then make up 10. That was the thoughts I have, which we have in Revelation 9:12, says one woe is past and behold there comes two woes more hereafter. And so if we combine that makes the 10. What other thoughts do we have? Any other thoughts on the number 10? What is significant of the number 10? If nobody has any thoughts, we won't take time on it. The number 7 is generally understood to picture a spiritual completeness, on the spiritual plane, whereas number 10 is completeness on the earthly plane. We have many places where the 7 is mentioned. For example, in Revelation 1:16 we have the 7 stars, Revelation 1:20 the 7 churches, Revelations 2:1, the 7 spirits of God in the midst of the 7 golden candlesticks. Revelations 5:1, the 7 seals. Revelations 5:6, we have the 7 spirits of God, and then 8:2, we have the 7 trumpet, and then Revelations 10:3, the 7 thunders utter their voices. And then we had what was the difference in the significance of number 10 to that of number 7? We didn't seem to have anybody for that one. Yes, we got one.
Brother Gray, just from the Companion Bible, it has the 10 denotes ordinal perfection, another new first after the ninth digit when numeration commences anew. And 9, like the ninth one, was denotes finality of judgment, that is 3 times 3, the product of divine completeness. The number 9 or its factors or multiples are seen in all cases when judgment is a subject. It also says that the 4 perfect numbers, which are 3, 7, 10, and 12, have for their product the remarkable number 2,520. It is the least common multiple of the 10 digits covering all numeration and can therefore be divided by each of the 9 digits without a remainder. It is the number of chronological perfection, 7 times 360.
good, thanks for your thought there. Yeah, that's generally the thought, is perfection, but on the earthly plane rather than the spiritual plane. And 10 is it comes up many, many times in the scriptures. For example, Daniel 10:1, the young Israelites wanted to be given pulses to eat for 10 days. And then in Zechariah 8:23, it will come to pass that 10 men out of all languages will take hold of the skirt of him that is a Jew. And then we have the 10 virgins that went out, and the woman in Luke 15:8 that had 10 pieces of silver. And in Luke 17 and 12, there was the 10 lepers that were cleansed. And then in Luke chapter 19 and 13, the 10 pounds that were given to the for them to prophesy. So that was the next one is the 4. Will these plagues come on the called out church? What thoughts do we have there?
Sorry, there's still one regarding the 10 plagues of Egypt.
Yes, go ahead.
And on the 10 plagues of Egypt, we remember 3 of them, the first 3, were on all the land, that is Egypt and Goshen, the area where the Hebrews resided. And the next 7 plagues were on the Egyptians only. So it was not on the land of Goshen. So we have really affecting there, we have got already been shown a number 7.
Good, yes, thanks very much for that. That seems to be a good little picture there, that they're not going to come upon the church. I'll just let Henry speak now. He's got his hand up.
If the watchers of verse 15 are part of the church, they could be there, but then the plagues mightn't really be upon them. Could it be that the church is still there, but it's not affecting them as it's meant to do on the rest of Babylon? Thank you.
Yes, thanks, Brother Henry. Yes, that's possible. You're saying that the church may not be taken, but they're not going to have the plagues affecting them. And that certainly is a possibility. Anybody else got something there on the question of whether the church is going to have to go through those plagues or not? No. Did we have anybody? Oh, yes.
Just looking at the plagues themselves, verse 2 says the plague will be on the people who worship the beast, so that's certainly not going to be the church. Verses 8 and 9 says that the sun will scorch people with fire and they refuse to repent. Well, that won't be the church, because they have already repented and turned to God. Verse 10 says that men gnawed their tongues in agony and they cursed God, so that won't be the church. Verse 19 says God remembered Babylon the Great and the cities of the nations collapsed. Well, I shouldn't imagine, but it is possible that the members of the church could be in amongst those cities, that's true. Verse 21, the hail fell and men cursed God, so that won't be the church there, because the church never cursed God. So I would say in the majority of cases, the church are not involved here. That would be my view.
Yes, I think that's the right thought. The church is not involved. Anybody got perhaps any other scriptures which bring that out? That the church won't have to go through this time of trouble at the end of the age. Alright, if you haven't, we won't sort of take time. I was thinking of Luke 21 and the 36th verse. Watch ye therefore and pray always that ye may be accounted worthy to escape all those things that shall come to pass and stand before the Son of Man. So that seems to be the thought. Those that are accounted worthy won't have to go through that great tribulation. And that's always been the general thought, that they're going to be taken up just maybe in that great time of trouble at the opening of it, if they're going to be taken out of the world and glorified, they might be slain at that time and be taken out just in the opening stages of it. Pictured by Elijah taken up in the whirlwind and the fiery chariot. And then we have 2 John 1:18. Look to yourselves that you lose not those things which you have wrought, but that you receive a full reward. So some are going to be accounted worthy, not to have to go through those things, and that these are the ones that are going to receive the full reward. Number five, Revelation 16:1, the bowls contain the wrath of God, whereas in chapter 15:1, the seven angels have the seven last plagues. Is there any significance in this? It might seem perhaps quite an unusual question to ask, but I know some have found a difficulty here in this one, and that's why I've just put that in. The bowls contain the wrath of God, and the others were the plague. So what is their answer there? Yes, go ahead.
I didn't see any problem with it. I thought the bowls were the means of pouring out the wrath.
Good, thanks.
Yeah, I agree with that, Brother Greg. But if you look at verse 7 of chapter 15, it says, one of the four living creatures gave to the seven angels seven golden bowls filled with the wrath of God, who lives forever and ever. So it's they're one and the same thing. The bowls, the seven bowls, are the seven parts of God's wrath, or seven plagues, in other words.
Good, thanks for that. Yes, anybody else got anything before I say anything? No, if you haven't, well, we will move on. I understand that they're both speaking of the same thing. The plagues would be the manifestation of God's wrath. The manifestation of God's wrath. And a verse that seems to show that they're both the same thing. These bowls all contain the wrath of God that has been poured out. But yet, if we look at the 16th chapter, Revelation 16 and verse 9, it said, "And men were scorched with great heat, and blasphemed the name of God, which has power over these plagues." So that gives us really the answer. What has been poured out is the plagues. Because it calls them plagues here, and in the other places it was called the wrath of God. And this verse I've just written down shows that the two terms are synonymous. Here we have that which had been poured out is referred to as plagues, whereas the angels were giving bowls containing the wrath of God. We notice that the correct term is bowls, it's not vials. as the King James have. One commentator has pointed out it's not just a little restricted narrow thing, but it's a big bowl. Brother Frank Chalew makes the following a comment regarding the plagues. He says, not literal, the calamities, the vials of the wrath of plagues are messages of truth that have an adverse effect upon nominal Christendom. End of quote. The plagues are poured out mainly on the nominal Christian world. The sixth one, this is verse 2, the bowl is poured out on the earth. In verse 3, it is poured out on the sea. What is meant by being poured out on the earth in distinction to the sea? Give some thoughts on the grievous sore which came upon those that had the mark of the beast, and what is the image of the beast? That's the sixth one. What thoughts do we hear? Yes, Brother Darrell.
Well, I've got an answer for the second part of your question. I haven't got an answer for the first, but if you go back to chapter 13, excuse me, you'll find that where the image of the beast is introduced, it's well, there's quite a section there. Maybe I should brief it a bit by just going chapter 13, 14 to 17, just for brevity. It says, because of the signs he was given power to do on behalf of the first beast, he deceived the inhabitants of the earth. He ordered them to set up an image in honour of the beast who was wounded by the sword and yet lived. He was given power to give breath to the image of the first beast so that it could speak and cause all who refused to worship the image to be killed. He also forced everyone, small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on his right hand or on his forehead so that no one could buy or sell unless he had the mark, which is the name of the beast or the number of his name. And this calls for wisdom. If anyone has insight, let him calculate the number of the beast, for it is a man's number. His number is 666. So I would assume from that that it would be the Roman Catholic system, because 666 is the same number as the papal church. That would be my assumption.
Good, thanks for that. Yes, the beast would be the Roman Catholic system, wouldn't it? And then there's the image of the beast. Who have we got next? Nobody else? Yes, Brother Henry.
There's a similarity in chapter 8 of Revelation with the trumpets. And the first angel sounded with a trumpet and it was cast upon the earth. And the second angel sounded, and there's a great burning fire was cast into the sea. So whether there's any significance in earth and sea being, you know, similar to in the other one. I know some brethren think the different trumpets and plagues and different things are one at the same time as the other or something like that. And it's just I was just wondering about that. So there's a suggestion. Thank you.
Anybody else got something for us? All right. Well, firstly about the difference between the land and the sea. When we think about the difference between the earth and the sea, we really get the answer that the earth is firm and stable. It does not move, whereas the sea is forever restless and agitated. It's never at rest. Even on a calm day, when we have what you could call a grassy sea, the waves are still continually coming in and out, 24 hours a day. How well this pictures the agitated masses of mankind. And the earth is generally thought to picture more firm and stable society. We think, of course, particularly about the the scripture in Luke about the sea and the waves roaring and men's hearts failing for fear. And then we have Isaiah 57 and 20, the wicked are like the troubled sea when it cannot rest, whose waters cast up mire and dirt, And I think that the restless and the troubled sea, the restless masses of mankind, that's something that has been demonstrated greatly over the last 12 months. We've seen agitations in the nations all around the world. They've toppled the governments, and of course it's going on today in Syria, and there's been a host of governments that have been toppled by the restless masses. They're agitating, they say, against greed and inequality. And back in Brother Russell's day, that's exactly what he forecast, wasn't it? He referred to the Lord's great army, and he referred to them as the common people. And that's something, of course, that's still, I think, pretty much in the future. This is just the start of it. And it says that the wicked are like the troubled sea. Those that are agitating, we wouldn't look upon them as being the wicked, but there would be some of the wicked in amongst it. We're doing it for the wrong reasons. But I think the majority feel that they are trying to improve the situation. They can see that there's a great amount of greed and inequality in the world. I think that's something that we can see at the present time being fulfilled. As a matter of fact, you might remember some little time back they had a special day when all the nations around the world were asked to demonstrate, and they had 80 nations all on the one day that were demonstrating. So that's something I think we can see it being fulfilled. Just go to Revelations chapter 15, 2 for a minute. And I saw as it were a sea of glass mingled with fire, and them that had gotten the victory over the beast, and over his image, and over his mark, and over the number of his name, stand on the sea of glass, having the harps of God. And I saw as it were a sea of glass mingled with fire. That could, I feel, picture a glassy sea. We've heard that term, haven't we? When the sea is smooth, as smooth as possible, as a glassy sea. I know that has been applied to the labour at the tabernacle, but I'm just wondering whether it may apply to that future time, which it's going to come about when they will say peace and safety. So it looks like there's going to be a time for a very short a period when the trouble is going to end, and they're going to say peace and safety, but it's only for a very brief period. Then sudden destruction cometh upon them. And the beast has been brought out papacy. The image of the beast is generally understood to be the Protestant churches. Possibly in the future, it's been thought that the churches are going to combine, and it could mean it more at that time. We have the two horn beast, which is the one that is going to be the prominent source behind it, which is going to bring them together, and that has been thought to be the Church of England. And of course part of the Church of England has broken away and combined with the papacy at the present time. The seventh one, please explain what the sea represents and what happens to the blood after death. It says every living soul dies. Is this a literal death? If not, what does it mean? So, explain about the blood. What happens to the blood when a man dies after death? Anybody got any thoughts there? Yes. All right, go ahead.
There's something I don't understand, or it's a bit confusing. There's only a few people here compared with everyone that's been born on the earth, but in the millennium there'll be one generation, the whole mankind will be there. In the little season the same applies. So why would the... I think it must be at the end of that age, not now. I mean, there's only a few compared with everyone now. Seems strange that these things in Revelation here apply now instead of later for everyone.
You were thinking that the plagues were at the end of the millennial age. Is that what you were saying?
Yes, because Satan's let out again. What's the reason? It doesn't make sense there. But never mind, I just thought I'd mention it.
Okay, well, thanks for your thoughts there. Yes, Brother Darren. Oh, sorry, I didn't see it. Okay, Brother Graham. Thanks, Brother Graham.
I don't want to go back or be contentious, but, you know, I have some concern about assuming the beast and the image of the beast. I believe I understand why that was a very real possibility or concept in the last century or even the century before. But, you know, today, unless there's going to be a miraculous resurrection, I know that the beast received a deadly wound and the deadly wound is healed, I know that. But, you know, we have a chap in Canberra, Bishop Patrick Power. He was a bishop in the Roman Catholic Church in the Diocese of Canberra-Goulburn for 50 years. 50 years only, he's just retired. When he began his bishophood, Bishop Crick or Bishop whatever it is, he said there were about 15% of Catholics on the roll who did not attend church. That was 50 years ago. He was asked the question, what differences or what changes have you noticed in the church? And he said, well, 15% did not attend church. Today, it would be lucky if 15% did attend church. So the facts are at least around in our area. So, you know, I have some problem getting scriptural justification for saying that the beast and the image are the Roman Catholic Church, the Church of England. As well as that, you know, in England, in 2005 we read a document about the power which the Church of England had over the people. And if you did not go to church on one Sunday, I think you were charged, you were fined a farthing for not going to church. If you didn't attend church on two consecutive Sundays, I think it might have been a penny. You were fined for not going to church. And so it went on. Likewise in Rome, at one stage in history, according to the tourist guide, there were 1,000 churches in Rome at the peak of its dynasty, 1,000 churches, and they held 3 services per day in each church. In 2005, there were 300 churches, and they were only one third full. So I understand that the image of the beast might be miraculously restored, but it's a long way to go.
Good, thanks, Brother Graham. Well, it has been suggested because of the smallness of the numbers and the weakness of the churches that they're going to combine for strength because of the strength in numbers. But you mentioned about the image of the beast being the Church of England. I think it's the not just the Church of England. The Church of England, I think, perhaps was the moving factor behind it. The Revelations text seems to suggest that, but it could be a combination of all the churches. Anything else there? Oh yes, Brother Emmanuel. Sorry, I don't see you there.
That's all right. I was just going to make a general comment because the time feature of the plagues is important to have a general idea of when it is that the thought has been expressed, why couldn't it be at the end of the millennium? And some of the preamble to the time frame is important. The introduction to really these plagues, I think, is fairly important, particularly in Revelation 14. At the end of Revelation 14, we have the picture of the two harvests, which is really follows on from the parable of the wheat and the tares. If you recall, at the beginning of the age, tares were sown in the field of the earth by the devil, as explained by Jesus, but they were both allowed to grow until the end of the age, when the wheat and the tares would be separated and the tares would be burnt and destroyed. And this harvest, I think, is reiterated in a little more detail as introductory to the plagues. And it may be worthwhile reading Revelation 14 from verse 14 to the end of the chapter, because I think it introduces the not only the time setting but the framework for the plagues, which is squarely set at the time of the return of Jesus in harvesting not only the wheat but also harvesting what has grown up during the gospel age and fed into the winepress of the wrath of God. From verse 14 in Revelation 14, I looked, and therefore before me was a white cloud, and seated on the cloud was one like a son of man with a crown, that is, Jesus has returned with regal power, of gold on his head and a sharp sickle in his hand. He thrusts his sickle into the earth. The harvest of the earth is ripe. Then further down we have another harvest. This is an angel swung a sickle on the earth, gathered its grapes and threw them into the great winepress of God's wrath. They were trampled in the winepress outside the city, and blood flowed out of the press, rising as high as the horse's bridles for a distance of 1600 stadia. The point, I think, is that it sets it at the return of Jesus with regal power in the harvest period at the end of the age. The winepress here is what comes as a result of the false churches growing throughout the end of the age, and the plagues which are in the bowls as a result of this winepress oozing this grapes of wrath that have been harvested. So I think it's just a nice picture, sets it at the end of the gospel age during the harvest period rather than at the end of the millennium.
Yes, good, thanks. Yes, I would understand it to be that way at the end of the gospel age. Yes, Brother Daniel.
Your number seven says, what does the sea represent? Well, I think we all agree that the sea represents the restless masses of mankind. What happens to the blood after death? Well, I don't think we really know what happens after death, and we're not really told anything here. Every living soul dies. Is this a literal death? Now, that could be a good question to answer. Every living, verse 3 it is, and every living thing in the sea died. Well, we're not even sure what sea it was to start with. The earth has a number of seas. It was only what John actually saw in the vision, that particular sea. Those that were living in that sea died. So I don't think we can be too sure about that, but it does say a few verses on, further on, it's, you are just in these judgments. This is verse 5. You who are and who were the Holy One, because you have so judged, for they have shed the blood of your saints and prophets, and you have given them blood to drink as they deserve. Well, looking back in history, who are the ones who have shed the blood of the saints and the prophets? None other than the Roman Catholic system, in my view. So it has to be the Roman Catholic system there that the Lord is returning wrath upon. That'll be my answer.
Good, yes, thanks for that. You've answered this to you, the restless masses of mankind, and nobody's answered about the blood, which is rather significant what happens to that after death.
Oh, I'll just make a question or suggestion. Perhaps ones that are skilled in medical side of things who could explain what happens with the blood.
Yes, Brother Emmanuel's going to explain that.
I was going to explain, when someone dies, you know, the blood stops, the heart doesn't pump, the blood clots, and there's no exchange of any of the gases that you get with life, and it just clots and there's no flowing. There's no, just stay still. And so that's what depicts here, is what happens to that sea, and there's death, it just stops, there's no flowing anymore, there's no life in it.
Good, thanks for that. Now, Brother Emmanuel.
The blood, once a person dies, or for that matter, any animal that dies, it congeals, as has been said. The problem with it is it's a part of the body which putrefies extremely quickly, and that was one of the reasons that the Israelites were forbidden to eat blood. In that environment, it becomes diseased extremely quickly and kills whatever comes into contact with it. And there is a link with one of the plagues of Egypt, so that the significance here is that the sea, which became like the blood of a dead person, putrefies and kills whatever is within that sea. I think that's probably the significance.
Good, thanks for your thought. That would be part. I had a further part here I was wanting to bring out, which I felt was significant. So if nobody has anything more, the thought I want to bring out is, they say that when somebody dies, there's a separation in the blood into two parts, a serum and clot. In other words, there's a separation of the blood which there wasn't before. And this seems to be showing a division or separation of the people. And I think if we look at the world today and the people, when we look at the television every evening, I think that's becoming a clearer, the separation into the two parts. We see that the evil section is getting worse and worse, we're getting more evil. But at the same time, we're getting a lot of good people, actually, that are working hard to preserve the environment on the earth. I've been watching a program called Global Village, and that has been bringing that out strongly, that in many parts around the world, where the environment is being damaged, they are starting to repair it now. They're bringing the animals back in places where the animals have mostly gone. They're bringing ones back, and they've bred the animals back again, and they've been clearing away the feral animals which are destroying the literal ones, and also the trees and the other things which shouldn't be there. They are thinning them out and repairing the environment, and that's going on all around the world. And that's, I think, part of the preparation work for the millennial age. We're living in a day of preparation, but then the evil is getting worse also. The two things really are working together, and that's what we expect, because God is not going to intervene until the evil reaches the full, You remember that was always the case in the second Old Testament times. He didn't destroy them until the evil reached the full. And the other question about the death being literal, it's generally thought that it's not a literal death, that they're going to die as they were, as to what they were before. And that was the thought that had been presented there. Alright, we'll move on now. Give some thoughts on the rivers and fountains of water, what is symbolized by them being becoming blood. Anybody got anything there for us? Oh well, we won't waste time if there isn't anything. The rivers and the fountains of water. Water really pictures the truth. These picture the truth, the rivers and the fountains of water. And by becoming blood, it means really they're coming polluted. They become blood, they become undrinkable. It began to be recognized by many that the church they belonged to was not teaching the truth, and a lot are starting to come to understand that. When we speak of the nominal church, of course, we've got to recognize that there's a lot of good people in it. A lot of good people that are doing the best they can. We're on to 9 now. Verses 8 and 9. Is this a reference to the literal sun? If not, what is it referring to? Anybody got any thoughts then? Yes, Brother Henry.
Yeah, I was wondering if it's the sun is the gospel, whether it's, you know, in chapter 12 of Revelation, it has the woman with the moon under her feet and the sun on her head and the 12 stars, and whether it's the truth, whether, as it's been mentioned and brought earlier, what's happened the last 100 years or so, or a couple of 100 years, with understanding of the scriptures and the truth, and the reason for it seems to be, as Brother Darrell said, to men to repent, but they haven't. They're still going on their evil ways, and they don't like the truth, you know, of hell and eternal torment and those sort of things, and they've gone in other directions. And also, I think in the fourth trumpet it says about the sun. I haven't looked that one up, but and I wondered about it too, whether it was, that's what it was a reference to. Thank you. Just,
yes, good, thanks for that. Yes, I think that's the correct answer. It's the gospel light, it's the truth, isn't it? The religious leaders should be joyful to hear the truth, but instead they're scorched by it. They are unhappy to be told that much of what they have believed and have been teaching is error. And they're scorched by it instead of accepting it. A lot of people don't like to be told that they're wrong, do they? Henry's brought out about the woman clothed with the sun, and then in Revelation 19:17 there's an angel standing in the sun, and in Mark 4:6, when the sun was up and it was scorched because it had no root and it withered away, and that's the sort. The ones that are going to be scorched by the truth, they haven't got any root in themselves, really. The next question is 10, and that's verses on verses 10 and 11. What is the seed of the beast, and what is it illustrated by the gnawing of the tongue? If you can have some answers on that.
Well, if you look at darkness, it says in verse 10, his kingdom was plunged into darkness, men gnawed their tongues in agony. We know that darkness is a symbol of error. So we could well imagine that the beast, who is this huge religious antichrist, which I believe is the Roman Catholic system, I know some people don't, plunged into darkness. Well, they don't produce any truth at all. And the people who are following suffer. And according to this verse there, the men gnawed their tongues in agony, which is just really a picture of the adherence to that system suffering because of their lack of truth. That'd be my answer.
Yes, yes, good. Thanks for that. That's very good. I don't think I quoted before I didn't quote Malachi 4:2, but unto you that fear my name shall the Son of Righteousness arise with healing in his wings. And ye shall go forth and grow up as calves of the stall. And we didn't get any answers on the seat of the beast, did we? The seat of the beast would be his seat of power, we could say his throne. This plague strikes at the very heart of papal power. They are in authority, its rulers, its clergy. Knowing the tongue, that's where we have a similar expression you could say today. His followers, that is, the papacy's followers, would already be able to see the falsehood of the doctrine of papal infallibility. But the Pope has changed his view on several occasions. One of the big changes would be no more eternal torment, which of course is the truth, which is good. Verse 12, rather, it's question 11. Can we learn a lesson here from a literal Babylon of old? If so, give details. And who are the kings of the East? So, what lessons do we get from literal Babylon? This is a particularly interesting verse, and it helps us quite a lot to understand it, I think. Anybody got any thoughts there on what lessons we can learn from literal Babylon?
Well, just a brief comment on the Babylon of old. We know that it was a huge city, Babylon. It was one of the wonders of the world at that time under Nebuchadnezzar, but the Medo-Persians came and took it all over, and that was the end of the regime. So it went very quickly from probably the greatest city at that time in the world to within 100 years it was nothing. It was just desolate. In fact, I think one of the prophets said that the wolves or the jackals will dwell there. And that was all that was left of Babylon. But whether it refers to, in our text here, any reference to Babylon of old, I wouldn't think so. I think this is a completely different picture. It's talking here about the Euphrates being dried up, isn't it? Yeah. And the kings, in verse 12, the river Euphrates dried up to prepare the way for the kings from the east. Now, if you look at the east of, well, I presume it's the east of Babylon, that would be, I don't know, I don't think we've got an answer for that. I haven't been able to get an answer, the kings of the east. Maybe someone else has.
Yes, Brother Henry, he's got something, thanks for your thought.
Some of the other translations I found a bit interesting. The 20th century New Testament's got so that the road for the kings of the east might be made ready. And another one here's got so that the highway of the kings from the sun rising might be made ready. Kings from the sun rising. I was thinking of Matthew 13:43. And then shall the righteous shine forth as the sun in the kingdom of their Father. Hear, earth and ear, let him hear. That's about the sowing of the darnel or the, you know, and the harvest at the end of the world. It is just before that, so that may have a connection. Thank you.
Yes, good. Thanks for that, Brother Henry. Yes, Brother Emmanuel.
I was just going to add, I think probably the symbology is taken from the conquest of Babylon by the eastern powers. The powers east of Babylon were Medo-Persia, and Cyrus is painted as a type of Jesus. But going back to the type, the way that Babylon was taken, and we remember the last king was Belshazzar, and he had this inscription on the whilst they were parting to the moon god, many tekel upharsin, that they had been found wanting. And this is particularly appropriate to anti-typical Babylon. What Cyrus did, Cyrus actually diverted the waters of the river Euphrates, which was the lifeblood of Babylon. Having diverted the water, the bed was dried up and they were able to march in and take the city whilst they were engaged in revelry and drunkenness. And I think the typical picture has application to here. The kings from the east, numerous references to the return of Jesus as the astrophe, as the sun rising from the east, the glory of the kingdom of Jesus, and he is integral to the destruction of the old system, as we saw in the treading of the winepress of God. So there are anti-typical applications of Cyrus to Jesus and the saints and the destruction of Babylon, antitypically.
Good, thanks for that. That's very good.
The Euphrates is regarded through history as the boundary between east and west. Napoleon regarded that area as the best battleground in all his campaigns. The theory of the kings of the east has been one that's been troubling scholars, as I read, for centuries, and it wasn't until the aftermath of World War II that some theories began to fall into place. Up until then, there was no one single country strong enough to be regarded as the king of the East. But since the rise of communist China, it is now thought by some scholars that Communist China is now one of the major kings of the East, and by using the plural, it will probably also involve Japan and probably other Asian countries. But there's very little that I've found in my search about kings of the East until this theory has come about. That has to be some powerful conglomerate of kings that's going to be there for the big battle.
Good, thanks for your thoughts. That's Brother John Cameron. Anybody else got it? Oh, you got one there.
Yes, in the, among the numerous scriptures we have in Isaiah chapter 44, we find that God is foretelling that this is going to happen. And that is before the Jews even went into the captivity for the rebelliousness. And verse 27 of chapter 44 reads, "And the one, that is Almighty God, saying to the watery deep, be evaporated, and all your rivers I shall dry up. The one saying to Cyrus, he is my shepherd, and all that I delight in, he will completely carry out." In chapter 45, verse 1, this is what Jehovah has said to his anointed one, to Cyrus, whose right hand I've taken hold of, to subdue before him nations, etc., and open before him the two least doors, so that even the gates will not be shut. And that is, of course, what Cyrus, the general, did, who then later on became king then. And Darius, of course, he was working under Darius. Darius was the king of the Medes, and Cyrus then of the Persians. So we have got two of them that would then justify to speak of the king. And we find that Cyrus, the name Cyrus, means son, S-U-N. And so this prophecy, although being 150 years before it being prophesied, 50 years before, it has got also the application, of course, in what we look at in Revelation, and that regarding the future, where the Son, of course, of righteousness represents then Christ, Christ, head and body.
Yes, good, thanks for that. Yes, that's the right thought. That's the one that has generally been understood. Brother Russell originally brought it out in his day that the kings of the East are the church. It'd be the glorified church. And the drying up of the Euphrates is to make way for the start of the millennial kingdom. Yes, we've got one down here, Sylvia.
Yes, I'm not sure whether what I'm going to say is going to be that helpful to you, but I believe that most of these plagues are depicting different periods of history. For instance, I know I'm going backwards on your discussion, but I believe the first plague was in 1789, from studying this at a previous occasion, which was the French Revolution. I don't think anyone has mentioned that. And in what period, I'm not sure, but I believe the second verse, the third verse about the sea and being dead to sin, social order, is depicted there. And there seems to be, when I've studied this before, that there is some connection also between the seals and the trumpets. If you look back into the second trumpet, and it mentions the blood, fourth trumpet has the sun, the sixth trumpet has about the Euphrates. Now, I can't explain everything, and I don't understand it all myself, but there does seem to be, and if you, it needs a thorough study, I think, to study the whole Revelation. But there does seem to be some connection between all these things in Revelation. And as I say, I can't explain it, but except for the periods of time in the trumpets, I believe some people would say that the second trumpet was during 325 AD, and that the third trumpet was between 539 and 1453. The fifth, 601 to 936, and that was the first woe, also the fifth trumpet, and so forth and so on. Unless you go back into history and try and see some connection, I don't think you're going to get the full picture of what is here. Thank you.
Good, thanks for your thoughts, Sister Sylvia. I see you've been looking into it. We'll have to make this, I guess, the last one now, the last question. Yes, who have we got there? Brother Henry, yes. Is it Brother Henry? No, it wasn't you.
No.
Who is it?
No one.
I thought you had one down there. Yeah. Babylon of old, it was really a type or a picture of the papacy, Babylon the Great in the future. Medo-Persia dug a diversion channel by night and drained the water of Euphrates away, which was dried up. Thus they easily conquered the mighty Babylon. Medo-Persia's two-phase kingdom was typical of Christ's kingdom, with its two phases, heavenly and earthly. Medo-Persia's laws, once enacted, could never be changed, just as it will be with Christ's kingdom. Medo-Persia's kingdom was ruled over by Cyrus, which means the sun. Linda brought that out, I think. Christ's kingdom will be ruled over by the sun of righteousness. So we see how beautifully the picture fits. The river Euphrates was the channel of the life for Babylon the Great. The literal Babylon of old, I meant to say. All the commerce entered the city via the river. Just so with the antitypical Babylon, its lifeblood comes from the waters of the antitypical Euphrates. Babylon of old sat on the literal river. Babylon the Great sits on the waters of the antitypical river, as we see by Revelations chapter 17 and 15. Revelation 15, and this is the angel speaking to John. He says, "He says unto me, the waters which thou sawest, where the war sitteth, are people, multitude, nations, and tongue." So that is the little picture, I think, there. Babylon of old was on the Euphrates, and the water was dried up. That shows the papacy losing her support from the people, the multitudes and the nations and the tongues. Another translation of that same verse says, "Then the angel said to me, you saw the waters where the prostitute sits. These waters are the many people, the different races, nations and languages in the world." Once she loses that support, she comes to an end. How true the comment is there, how true the verse is there, that translation, because her tentacles encompass the whole globe, where once her billion odd members are enlightened and she loses their support, this, of course, the system finally comes to an end. She must first reign in power for a very brief time, one symbolic hour. She's going to be lifted up in power for a brief time, then thrown down like a great millstone. I just wanted to she's going to be actually destroyed by when he's revealed his revealment. Thessalonians 2:8 says, "And then shall that wicked be revealed, whom the Lord shall consume with the spirit of his mouth, and shall destroy with the brightness of his coming." That should be the present. I just wanted to, before we close, read one verse that I missed out on. We were talking about the sun before. It's the verse in Isaiah, and it's what it says basically. That the sun is going to be ashamed, and so that shows us what is going to happen eventually. In other words, the false church assistants, when they get an opportunity in the millennial age, the ones that wouldn't accept the truth and were being scorched by the sun, these are then going to be ashamed. Oh, here it is. It's Isaiah 24:23. It mentions Israel too here, of course. It says, "Then shall the moon be confounded." The moon is really a picture of the Jewish dispensation. "And the sun shall be ashamed when the Lord of hosts shall reign in Mount Zion and in Jerusalem before his ancients gloriously." So I think that's a very nice verse, because it shows that those who at the present time have the false doctrines, they're not going to be scorched by the sun at that time. They're going to be ashamed when the rain takes place. Well, thanks for your thoughts, and we have to leave it there. We didn't get through all of them, but our time is up.
Thank you, Brother Greg, and for conducting our study on the seven last plagues. We'll, for the sake of time, we'll have our interval now, and we'll be back at, if we could be seated, ready at 20 to 5 for our next talk. Thank you, Emmanuel.